sustainable hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the sustainable hour.
The Sustainable Hour acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we broadcast from, the Wurundjeri people. We pay respect to the elders past, present, and those who will come. At the Sustainable Hour, we take inspiration from the long history of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander activism and resistance, and seek to amplify the voices of marginalised groups. We acknowledge that there can be no climate justice until there is justice for all our Indigenous brothers and sisters. We know there is much for us to learn from the way they manage and nurture the land for millennia before it was stolen by the first white colonisers. Finally, we pay tribute to One Fire for the work they are doing in Geelong for reconciliation.
And speaking of country, I'm standing with Earth. I'm standing with Earth. I'm standing with Greta Thunberg, I would say. Or am I standing or am I running now? Because we have an election coming, right? And Tony, Colin, welcome to the Sustainable Hour. What do you call it? What do you call it when you step up and you say, I'm going to enter that race. I'm going to be a candidate in an election. Are you running or are you standing?
You can do both.
You stand for an election, then you run.
Yeah. Why I say I'm standing with Earth is because there is the school strike for climate, and there's a place. I don't know how I even got in there. Suddenly, I was clicking in Facebook. Bang! Suddenly, it said on my profile picture in Facebook, it said, I'm standing with Earth. I barely know how it got there, but beautiful. I thought that's a perfect slogan for our time. I am standing with Earth.
All right, I'll buy that.
And Mick, does that mean you're going to run for council?
That's a good question. Let's talk about that next week. I'm trying to get some women on board. You know, I'm a middle-aged, or what do you call it? I mean, I'm 57 years old. I'm a white middle-class kind of person. Do we need more of those in council? I don't think so.
No.
I think we need 25-year-old women in council. So I've been talking to four different women, not all of them 25, maybe in their 30s and so on, but women who say, I would like to run, but I'm a little bit, I don't know, can I do it? Is it, you know, going to be too hard and so on? So I'm trying to convince them that, yes, you need to step up now. Now is the time to run.
Yeah.
But we'll try and get some of them in the studio next week. Over to you now, Colin. What's the global outlook?
Oh, look, it's very much on that line, to be honest. I have three items for you this week. Two of them are from New York and the other one is from Canberra. One is very positive, one is negative, and the other one could go either way. So you get to work it out both ways. The first one's from New York. It's the head of the United Nations who's now set up a new committee, and he's going to meet regularly with young climate activists. These are going to be seven people from seven different nations, all of them aged between 18 and 28. And they're going to sit down on a regular basis with the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, and they're going to advise him on global warming issues. Now, he announced this on Twitter during the course of the last 2 days. It's going to be called the Youth Advisory Group, and it will provide, and I'm quoting here, perspectives, ideas, and solutions that will help us scale up climate action. And it's really taking on board the action that has been taken around the world by young people. And all of that, of course, was started by Greta Thunberg. Greta Thunberg is not going to be one of the panelists, and they're not saying why. They haven't announced it. Maybe she hasn't got the time these days. But the point is, from this piece of news, is that the voices of youth on climate action are being heard at the very top, the UN Secretary General. The second piece that I have for you is the Australian Institute. During the course of the last week, it released research as part of the new Global Energy Policy Tracker, and it showed that the Australian government, during the course of this pandemic, they have committed at least $479.5 million US dollars in unconditional fossil fuel support. our government is still supporting fossil fuels during this pandemic to a huge amount. I'll give you that number again. US dollars, $479.51 million in support for our fossil fuel companies. And our fossil fuel companies have made billions of dollars over the course of the last 60 years. And yet our government is pouring money into them during the course of a pandemic when we have stopped using, we've stopped flying, we've stopped driving. We're using far less fossil fuels and our government is pushing them. They're actually, the Australian Institute is calling it a war on renewables. Even when the government, the federal government came out with its plans for escaping from this pandemic, and they said we're going to be doing it by supporting climate action, that support was very much based around gas. So that too, they are looking for fossil fuels. They're looking after their mates who pour millions of dollars into the Liberal Party. And I just want everybody to know that, because we've got elections coming up. There are other things happening. So that's the good news and the bad news. They don't quite balance each other out. There's a lot more bad news there than there is good news. And then the third thing that I was going to bring up, and that's happened during the course of the last week, is that James Murdoch has left News International. He did so citing that he didn't agree with the Murdoch press. He doesn't agree with their stance on environmental issues, especially climate change, and most especially in Australia. Now, this could go either way. This could mean that the Australian press, which is basically Murdoch dominated, is going to now listen to that and move perhaps a little bit less from its right-wing stance. But it could also mean that they're going to say, good, we haven't got this break anymore upstairs, so we'll just go flat out on pushing the fossil fuels. We don't know which way it's going to go. But the one bit of good news that I read when I read all this, first of all, you won't read about this in the Murdoch press. You'll have to read about it in the very small sliver of our market that is non-Murdoch. But the good news is that between them, Catherine and James Murdoch donated $1.3 million to Joe Biden's election fund. So quite clearly, they have seen that Joe Biden and his environmental way of coming away from the pandemic has got much, much, much more sense than backing Trump. Unfortunately, his father and the rest of the Murdoch empire will be backing Trump. We know that because that's a way of making more money, and it's all about money. And that's something I can't quite understand. I never have been able to understand. When you get to be a billionaire, why do you still want to make more money? You can't ever spend it. But look, that's my roundup for the week.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Thank you very much for that global outlook. Once again, I mean, it just shows the story is changing, and it keeps changing all the time. This week, I opened the Financial Times, and I didn't open it. That's an old-fashioned way of talking, you know, sitting with a paper, newspaper. But Financial Times, come on, do you know what Financial Times is? It's like the institution of finances, you know, sitting in an airplane in business class, and you have these pink newspapers there, Financial Times. That's not Greenpeace, I tell you, but the headline this week, that's the first time I see something like that in Financial Times. Why we need to declare a global climate emergency now?
What?
In Financial Times? Then yeah. You know the story is changing, you know. Yeah. We've left it very, very late, but really now it looks like the media and everything is like beginning to come together, isn't it true?
We're now in the money zone. The money zone has realized that they've got to get on board or they won't make money in the future. And this is a really good place to be if you're an environmentalist.
That's right. And the other thing is, you know, I'm noticing that young people, and when I say young in this case, people in their early 20s or mid-20s are beginning to enter the scene and speaking up. And I think that's more or less the theme for what's happening in our little sustainable hour here today. Tony, would you like to introduce our two guests?
Yes, I certainly would, Mick. We've got, you talk about the commercial sphere. And I think one that's even more unlikely in a lot of ways is the court system. Now we've got a young lady, Catter O'Donnell, who is taking action against our federal government, using the courts to highlight the fact that they're going to, their lack of real action on climate is going to have a major influence on all aspects of our lives. I think she's particularly focusing on the commercial, again, on the economic side of things. But Catter, tell us all about it. What got into you to go down this pathway?
Yeah, definitely. So climate change is going to have a huge impact on our economy. And we can see that. We're already seeing with the bushfires this past summer, I think they've estimated to cost our economy around $100 billion. And the Great Barrier Reef dying is going to be horrible in itself, but it's going to cost billions of dollars. And farmers are struggling through years of drought. And it just goes on and on, really. There's climate change is going to be very expensive. And my case is coming through government bonds. So I'm an investor in government bonds, but when climate change has such a huge impact on our economy, it's going to impact the value of government bonds and the government's ability to pay back these bonds. So that's what this case is about. And it's also just really about, I want to educate myself and others on the financial risks of climate change.
No better way to do that. And we understand you're a law student?
Yeah, that's right. I'm in my fifth year of law at the moment.
Okay. Is that your final year?
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, when's this, the court case going to actually happen? Has there been any indication about that yet?
Well, we've just filed the case. So now we're just waiting for, I think everything's a bit slower with COVID at the moment, but we're just waiting for our first court date and our judge, and then also waiting for a response from the government. But that's the next step. It's the first case of its kind in the world. So it's pretty unknown territory, but it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Okay. Now, right beside you in Zoom, in our tunnel, in the hiatus, we've got Sarah Liberty.
Yes.
Sarah, you've just recently returned to Australia from overseas.
Yes.
Fire in your belly and a sparkle in your eye.
Absolutely.
What's caused that?
So I've lived overseas actually for quite a lot of my adult life. I was just finishing my Master of International Relations, majoring in Human Rights in Paris at Sciences Po. Which is one of the most prestigious academic institutions in the world for political science. So my major has been human rights, and I've taken a very active interest throughout my degree, both in climate action and how that's being done around the world, and also in online human rights. So I'm back in Australia. It's good to be home. Like I said, I've lived overseas. I've lived in London. I've lived in New York. I've lived in Yogyakarta. So I sort of consider myself Australian, but also, I guess, someone with a very global, international perspective on things. And when listening to what Catter has had to say regarding the economic impact of climate change, I really stand in solidarity with her, because I think that, you know, we've been talking about climate change in Australia for over 30 years, and the moral and the human impact, the human rights and the social justice argument is just not working. You know, I do admire all of the actors in the climate action space for trying to push that message, but with our government, it's not getting through. And so I really, you know, I believe we need to continue to raise awareness about the economic impact, but also, you know, our head of the Australian Defence Force has actually gone, you know, and said very publicly that if we don't do something about climate change very, very urgently, the humanitarian, the human security impact of climate change is going to be potentially disastrous. And we're not talking just about what will happen to Australians. We're talking about what will happen to our neighbours in the Pacific region through things like climate-related emergencies. So I've come back from Paris feeling like, you know, I've got a really solid academic perspective on this. And I know through my studies, and I worked with some very, very prominent lecturers who worked for Human Rights Watch International, Amnesty International, UN ambassadors, the UN, they all express deep concern about the way that our government is not taking swift enough action around climate change. So, you know, I'm back as a climate activist, but I also have a new project that I can tell you about.
Terrific. We've got two determined women who,
absolutely,
who aren't going away.
No way.
Yeah. Just really like the way you said that you're in solidarity with Qatar. Like, yeah, we're all connected on this. It's yeah, our world. It's being stolen. Democracy's being stolen by a very small amount of people who are very unhappy anyway. They're not benefiting from their greed. And we're the collateral damage. So I think, yeah, more power to both of you and all the other people that we interview each week that are so determined to right these wrongs.
Yeah, definitely. I think people have been saying that to me. It's like really important that it's a young person like me taking this on. But I think, and it is left to young people a fair bit, but it's not just a young person's issue. It's an everybody issue. And we're seeing the effects right now. It's not just going to be something in the future. It's affecting us all.
Absolutely. There's people dying of floods in India, Bangladesh, number of places right now.
Sarah, you mentioned this thing about it doesn't work to be talking about, you know, the moral issue, or it certainly hasn't worked the last 30 years. We have, for instance, as an example of that, Pope Francis, who is in a way the leader, the religious leader for 1.2 billion people on the planet, all the Catholics. And he spoke in very, very clear words 5 years ago about how we need to change our society entirely, move away from fossil fuels. And in the 5 years that have gone, he has not stopped. Just this year, on the five-year anniversary, they came out with a 220-page guide manual to how churches can divest, how they can get really serious about completely stopping polluting the air. Now, there's a church leader speaking from a moral point of view. And do you think people are listening? Do we have Catholics in the government who are completely ignoring the Pope? Yes, we do. Hmm. So what are we learning? The morals don't work, or what?
Well, look, yes, you're right. The morals don't work because all politicians appear to have the ability to put their own personal morals on one side when it comes down to making the decisions. And usually it's the money that talks. But if I can talk to both of our guests that we have here today, first of all, Sarah, you said it's been obvious for 30 years. In truth, as an elderly person, I can tell you that it has been obvious for more than 50 years. Yeah. David Suzuki was talking about it in the mid-1970s. And even then, it was quite old at that time. So we have been ignoring it. I have to say that COVID-19 has actually done a wonderful job of pushing it to the front. The bushfires initially pushed climate change into the front. Then it was forgotten with the first wave of COVID-19. But now, as you pointed out, Mick, it's on the financial pages of the papers now. So the fact that was first, what should we say, it was first put down when it was pointed out that global emissions had reduced dramatically due to COVID-19, we're not flying anymore to the amount that we were before. We're not driving. And that itself brought the issue into the mainstream. And we're just picking up and taking it from that. But Katha, you're the person who really I'd like to address if I can. You're a fifth year law student and you're already thinking in a very tricky lawyerish way. I'd like to ask you why you chose to go down this particular lane to sue the government on behalf of bondholders rather than being on behalf of just people in the community.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's pretty important to everyone because I'm a holder of government bonds, but many Australians probably even unaware that they're holders of government bonds through their superannuation accounts. Mm-hmm. So it is very relevant to everyone really in Australia and everyone everywhere. But yeah, I first realised I've always been concerned about climate change. Like you were saying, it's my whole life. It's been a really big issue for me. I first started thinking about the financial risks when I heard David Barndon, who's now my lawyer, he came to my university to give a guest lecture. And so it's a climate law subject, and he was giving a lecture on the financial risks of climate change. So that's what really sparked my interest about that. And I think he's got another big case against the superannuation fund for their not disclosing climate risks. Mm-hmm. When he started speaking, I changed my super over because I realised that investing and climate change have such a huge link. And I think that's also what I really want to highlight with this case is that really strong link between how we invest and the economy and climate change. It's all so closely related.
And are you, this might seem a facetious question, but are you really expecting to win? Because if you do, you'll have a result similar to Mabo. You'll have a game-changing result. And let's face it, you are appealing to judges who are not politically minded as a general rule, although you must be aware they're appointed by the government. Oh, what I asked you is basically why you're taking the bond. Now I know you're asking the government to be financially angled when it comes to climate change, because that's what bonds are. That's their way of raising money, and yeah, they sell them to large corporations and
exactly. Else. Thank you. You actually did remind me. I did have something I wanted to say about that. I think it does have a very real possibility because there are major financial regulators and investors around the world that are taking this seriously. Like you said on the front page of the Financial Times, it has become a major issue, and we've seen there's an example last year with the Swedish Central Bank, and they actually sold all of its Western Australian and Queensland government bonds because they reasoned that those states weren't doing good work on climate. Mm. So we're seeing that our government's response and how it's putting in place staying reliant on fossil fuels is really a major concern for people and investors around the world. And if climate disclosure does become a requirement, it's going to change the way that people are investing and government's response to the risk.
Now, on a much more personal level, you're a 23-year-old student. How are you funding this particular effort, bearing in mind that we all know that it's incredibly expensive to go through the courts?
Yeah, definitely. I am very grateful that I am not paying anything. My lawyers are all acting pro bono.
Pro bono.
Which is amazing. Yeah, it's a huge task, and yeah, they're doing an incredible job there. Yeah, really.
Wonderful. And how far along the path are you?
Well, we've just started, I suppose, but it's taken a while to get here. But we've just filed with the federal court. So yeah. Mm.
Excellent.
We've been talking quite a bit during the COVID crisis about that we actually can take inspiration from the COVID crisis in the sense that we now see the airplanes parked in the airports. We see communities come more together and help each other, opening up and becoming more caring in a way about each other. And many, many other good signs of that we are heading in an interesting direction when it comes to also tackling the climate crisis from a personal point of view. Now, I would like to ask the two of you a very fundamental question that I'm thinking about. And that is, if we imagine, you know, we are here, 7 billion people on this planet, humanity, how are we going to get humanity to go in the right direction at a large scale where it really matters? I've suggested the word hiatus, that we need to take ourselves into that sort of mode. Hiatus means a pause. It means a place where we do less, where we cut down and we downsize. And I'm trying to say that we can actually convince people that the hiatus is not such a bad place to be. Yes, we may be making less money, but at the same time, we have more time for other things like being social, talking, meditating, going out in nature, and many, many other things that don't pollute the air. So the hiatus, in my suggestion, is a place we go where we wait until technologies really improve, and one day we can fly electric. One day we can do all sorts of things without polluting the air, and then we'll start doing it again. But until then, we just wait. We just pause. It's not a strike, but it is a big hiatus. My question to you is, to get people there, we talked about the morals. Apparently, it doesn't help to come with a stick and talk about morals like, you know, blah, 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 blah. Now, how do we get people there? Do we get them? I'm not talking about the broader masses of you know, not just Australia, but of the world. Do we get people into a mode of hiatus where they don't want to fly around as crazy as we've been doing until now? Just as a symbol of all the things we've been doing, where we polluted the air. We knew we were doing something wrong, but we kept doing it. Do we use the stick, or do we use, which is the law, and which is, you know, being sort of saying, you cannot do this, you cannot do that, and so on. Or do we use the carrot, which is to say, it's nice over here, it's nice in this hiatus. You know, we have time to develop ourselves, we have better relationship with our neighbors. So is it the carrot or the stick that's going to take us forward?
Without a doubt, yep. Nick, it is the carrot. Because we have seen...
Colin, I did not ask you.
Oh, sorry. But I just want to give a couple of examples, if I can. Number one, the dopey people who have been recording themselves not wearing masks and confronting people. When you use the stick, you bring those people out. And contrasting that, I will say the number of people who have been queuing up and ordering bicycles. Now, nobody has ever said, hey, come on, let's all get on bicycles because it's probably the best social distancing short transport. But the penny has dropped, and without any publicity at all, many, many more people are out on bikes. That's, if you like, a carrot approach, because they're getting fitter and they're not polluting in any way or using up any fossil fuels. So look at those two different methods, and it's quite obvious that if you just show people that this is a sensible way to go, they'll do it. Now I'll hand over to our guests. I'm sorry about that.
So let's hear from both of you, because I know it's a big question, but I'm really keen to hear what you think is the way to go for us. Sarah first.
Yeah, so I've been working in the climate action space for at least 5 years now professionally. I worked at the Climate Council of Australia, working very closely with Tim Flannery and Amanda McKenzie, where I transitioned to the non-profit sector to working in civil society back in about 2013 or 14. And from then I moved, so I was a senior communications advisor there. And what we really realized is that back then there was very, very little coverage of climate change in the media. So my work day in and day out, every single day, was to try and secure media coverage around climate change. Now, one of the key issues is that it is such an overwhelming topic for many, many people to get their heads around. And many people, if you just talk about climate change as a whole, you know, its potential catastrophic impacts on humanity, it doesn't work. People tune out because they think, how can I possibly make a difference? So the work that we did at the Climate Council was to always try and break it up into different aspects of how climate change is impacting Australians. For example, food security, or maybe you know, real estate investments, or things like, you know, why transitioning to renewable energy isn't actually that expensive in the long run. So we would always break it up into things that everyone could try and do. Not everyone can do the same thing day in and day out in their daily lives in terms of addressing climate change, but everyone can do something, whether it's you know, I've never owned a car, to be honest, in my life. I've managed to live on four continents. So, you know, I've always used public transport or rode a bike, or I grew up in the country riding horses. So, you know, everyone can do something, or whether it's always shopping sustainably and buying renewable or secondhand clothing rather than buying from, you know, fast fashion chains, or whether it's, you know, having that reusable coffee cup rather than buying a new, you know, disposable coffee cup with a plastic lid every day. Everyone can just, you know, adopt one change at a time. And that's one way of encouraging people to just do something that will help, really help change the planet. If we all do something small in our everyday lives every day, then that will have a ripple of change, and that will have, you know, a really dramatic impact. And after working at the Climate Council, I then worked at ActionAid Australia, which is a humanitarian organisation, and it focuses, the work there was mostly focused on women's rights, but a lot of our work was also talking about how climate change disproportionately impacts women, particularly those who might be in our neighbouring countries in the Pacific, because when natural disasters hit, they're the ones left taking care of the families, you know, trying to put food on the table, whilst the men might be dealing with the, you know, the catastrophic impacts of a cyclone. So yet again, through media awareness and through public affairs, we would always try and promote climate action in a way that felt accessible and, you know, in a positive way for people, because I think, you know, trying to create fear around climate change is not helpful. I think that we just have to continue to push the positive message that change is possible. And I really, you know, admire Kata for what she's doing, because certainly, you know, we need to all think about how we consume and how climate change is going to have an economic impact. It already is. It already is, particularly my dad's a farmer. So his work, the work that he does, has already been impacted quite significantly by things like drought. And obviously the bushfires were terrible. They were very, very close to where my parents live in southern New South Wales on their property. So yeah, I think, to me, you know, promoting the real, for everyday Australians, raising awareness of the fact that we can all do our part, we can create change. And if you just look at, you know, the huge worldwide climate marches that were led by young people last year, I mean, and Greta Thunberg, it is possible. The only thing that's ever changed the world is an individual, you know. We as individuals we can all feel self-empowered to create change. And that's the message that I really try and push throughout all of the work that I do as both a climate activist and a human rights advocate.
Let's get back to Greta in a moment. And now over to our Australian Greta. I'm kidding a little bit, but Kata, you are standing up there. You're 23 years old. You are like the next level. You're taking it to courts. Is it the carrot or the stick that's going to get Australia on board the way Sarah is talking about?
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. I really agree that it's accepted. It's needing to accept that change. And I think, like with COVID, we can accept that we all need to do things differently and that will benefit us all. And I think it's about, change is always a bit scary because it's unknown, but I think we know that this change is going to be for the better. If we're making changes that are going to help us have a healthy and sustainable planet, like, I think that's really exciting and something I want to be part of. I'm sort of more scared of staying how we are and blindly like running towards catastrophe. That's scary to me. I'm really excited for this inevitable change that's going to happen. And I do think it comes from individuals, everyone, that's where change first happens. But we also need to have leadership that is encouraging us and showing the way. We need to have the government telling the truth about the risks of climate change and giving us policies and systems that allow us to make change that benefits us all.
Yes, and look, Kathy, you might not realise it, but you're actually also providing a little bit of the carrot, because news of your suing the government hits all of the pages of every newspaper and every current affairs television show. You'll find yourself a celebrity. You'll find yourselves being interviewed. And this puts it in front of people who wouldn't necessarily be thinking it. And you're putting the message out there to people, hey, look, we can do something. It must be worthwhile doing it, because this particular person is standing up and standing up for it. So more power to your elbow. But thank back you. Again to you, Sarah. You said you had a new impetus that you wanted to tell us about. Can I ask you what that was?
Sure. So as I mentioned, in addition to always being very interested in climate action and climate change, I've grown up primarily with the internet. And I've taken a very strong interest in now online human rights. In Paris, I did some studies in how democracy and, you know, online networks impacting democracy. And what I realized, and this has also come from my own personal experience, is that our online human rights are no different to our offline human rights. Yet I don't know that many Australians are aware of this. And the reason I say this is I wasn't. So I'm launching a new NGO that will be dedicated to promoting online human rights through collective action, through forming a national alliance. It's called Just Social. And it's accredited already formally as a federal NGO through the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profit Commission. And it connects to sustainability because it will be trying to promote collective action through all of the different actors that work in the online space. So that's not just civil society, nonprofits, private businesses, but also law enforcement, government and activists. And this sort of was triggered by my own personal experience. I had my own online human rights violated a few years ago by an ex-partner who hacked into all of my social media and email accounts. This was during a time when I was in a domestic violence relationship, which I left, but he continued to surveil and to monitor me whilst I thought he was out of my life, but he wasn't. And I went to the police, but it actually took weeks of my own perseverance to get them to take out an ABO. I did eventually get it. They didn't bring to my attention the fact that someone hacking into my online accounts is actually it's a breach of the law. You know, it's breaking the law. And through the research, I've got a board of five who are amazing. I've got an Indigenous Australian who's one of my board members. You might know him. He's a very high-profile young climate activist called Josh Gilbert. He won Young Australian Conservationist of the Year. I also have a board member who's based in New York. So I've got a really incredibly diverse board. So through the research that we've done, you know, I think 8 in 10 Australians now use social media. 99% of people in that millennial age bracket use social media every day. But yet there are still extremely alarming rates of things like online gender-based violence and bullying and online abuse, particularly for people in regional areas, which is, a statistic that I found out recently. So we will be looking to address issues like these and to work with partners to advocate for greater policy change in this area from our government, and to try and understand better how our law enforcement are being trained in online rights. And we'll also work in a similar way to the way that the Climate Council works, as like a communications organisation that pushes out news relating to the online space and, you know, news and developments, whether it's related to artificial intelligence, whether it's related to how our online data is being managed. I know also from research that quite a significant proportion of Australians are concerned about how their data might be utilised or accessed. So it's kind of going to be about raising awareness through the media and through advocacy, and through trying to encourage everyone who's working in the online space to use the same language, because there's so many different terminology, things that are being used. The government talks about cybersecurity, there's an e-safety commissioner, there's other organisations that talk about online bullying, online harassment, yet, you know, none of them are all linking the fact that their work actually relates to online human rights. So it's, you know, I've always been quite an ambitious, determined person, and I'm very excited about doing this because, you know, the online space is evolving very rapidly, but I'm very, very much a part of that. And I think it's a, you know, it's a wonderful opportunity that the internet provides us. But, you know, I think that my work will be making, trying to make sure that it is, as the online space is accessible and safe for all Australians.
That's really important, Sarah, to begin to take this more seriously, because it's as if we haven't understood the power of the internet, in particular Facebook. We saw an election in America that maybe had a different outcome because of what was going on in Facebook, or the fake advertisements. And to be honest, at the previous federal election here in Australia, the week before we were supposed to go and vote, all these fake ads were flying around and fake statements about this and that in this Facebook space. My question to both of you, Katja also, is Facebook a monster? Should we just get off Facebook entirely? Or how are we going to deal with this? You know, and I speak as with the interest of that we want to see progress with the climate movement, in the sense that we all need to understand what's going on here. And the last thing we need are people who are giving us lies. Deliberate lies.
Well, I think, you know, what's been interesting is Facebook's actually recently released a new declaration of their, they have a new civil rights declaration that they made, I think, about a week ago. It's interesting also in the United States, Facebook, Amazon, I think Google and one other tech giant, are all facing Congress at the moment because of their huge market power. Should we all get off Facebook? I don't think so. I really think that what we should be doing is trying to have more, create more dialogue with this platform. But what I do want to know more from Facebook, and, you know, I would like to, you know, in my work, try and work with them, is to try and understand who is moderating their content? Because at the moment, we don't know. We know, from what I understand, it's a mixture of humans and potentially artificial intelligence, or, you know, it's done by bots or whatever. We don't even know if the humans who are doing that moderation are trained in things like diversity, inclusion, and human rights. So, no, I don't think Facebook's the monster, but it is deeply concerning the amount of power Facebook has. I mean, the population of Australia on Facebook, I think, is 60%. Facebook has a greater population than many of the countries in the world. I can't give you an exact statistic, But yes, it, you know, Facebook does have a lot of power, but I don't think it's going to be possible for us to just completely remove ourselves from Facebook. I don't think that's the answer. I think that trying to have dialogue so that we can try and get them to open up and, you know, start to converse with people like myself and other actors about how they're actually taking responsibility, because to date, rather than being proactive and taking a responsible approach, they've taken the liability approach in terms of the way that they express, you know, the way that they moderate their content. And I think that we need to try and encourage the big tech giants that are out there to promote awareness more about what is good, what is safe online behavior. Yeah, that's how I'd answer that question.
Yeah, and I'm definitely not an expert on Facebook. I personally don't really like it and try to avoid it as much as possible. But I think it's definitely something we all need to think about, is just rethinking what we're hearing on the news. And I think it's always really important to give it a second thought about where this news is coming from and what it's trying to tell you.
Exactly. Because at the moment, we actually have, you know, we have an institution that we would think, you know, everyone would respect. It's called the Australian Energy Market Operator, AEMO. They've just come out with some different statements. They are actually telling us, and this is coming from authorities in a way, that Australia at the moment is on track to experience the fastest energy transition in the world, with gas prices going to get, you know, more and more expensive, with battery cost and renewables continuing to get more and more cheap. That's the AEMO story. But that's not the story we hear in Facebook.
It's very interesting. Also, added to that, Mick, if I can say so, our federal government has taken Facebook, Google, and the other social media companies, has taken them to task and trying to charge them for using news content. This is all very well, except that they're not intending to charge them to use news content from either the ABC or SBS. It's only commercial companies. So it's really only, they're acting on behalf of Rupert Murdoch. And it's still the moneyed people that are talking. The excuses they're using by saying we're not going to charge them for ABC and SBS is because they're both supported by government. And we don't want government to get interfering into the social media. But it's still a very, very fraught area. And it, let's face it, it began as a way for young people to get together and find ways to do that. Who would have thought that, 25 years down the track, it would have been such a, as you say, a monster that is able to change elections. But the point is, the big one, of course, is Cambridge Analytical and their manipulation of Brexit and the Trump votes. By manipulating the algorithms, they can actually change the way that the images that you see on Facebook and how many things you're going to be looking at and what those inferences are. Because you don't really see people say, hey, you've got to vote for this. You see a gradual shift of inferences. And it's something, it's a little bit like the placing of things in aisles of supermarkets that will hit your subconscious. And it's something, it's because it's so obscure and obtuse, it's almost impossible to be able to regulate. But what we're doing now is we're putting this in front of Katter, who is going to be a future lawyer, and she's very much aware of it, I'm quite sure.
Yeah, I think it all actually does come back to what the basis of my case is about, and that's ensuring that, well, mine is that the government tells the truth, but all platforms should be telling the truth, especially about issues that are facing us all, which is climate change. I think everything needs to just start telling the truth about climate change as the very first step, so that we can all adequately get past that and start taking action. Because, yeah, I think we are currently seeing a global mobilisation around climate change, but it needs to start to turn into action everywhere.
Mm. One thing I would add is that, one thing that is concerning to me is that many, many people, particularly young people, might not be aware of how tech platforms like Facebook and Instagram do use algorithms that deliberately try and capture their attention online. This is something I know and I've studied under a very high profile academic and the head of digital at Libération in Paris, which is the most, I guess it's one of the more progressive newspapers, Gerard Hulabovic. And he was one of my lecturers and he's one of my inspirations actually. But yes, I interviewed him on my own podcast about some of the trends happening in the online space. And yeah, he has highlighted the fact that things like the way that social media does capture people's attention, people are not very aware of the fact that they're being deliberately held captive in a way on these accounts. But, you know, I still don't want to make them the enemy. I think, you know, it's better to try and have dialogue and encourage them to create change. And I think that the way that the Australian government has been engaging with tech platforms hasn't really been that helpful. From what I understand, it's been quite, you know, it's been quite tense, and basically they've been yelling at, you know, tech giants to change. And that's not a very, I personally don't believe that's the right approach. I'm a diplomat. I'm a human rights advocate. I'm someone who believes in promoting dialogue, and I think our government needs to change the way that it's engaging with tech platforms, because otherwise, you know, we're not seeing, I mean, we're certainly not seeing much change to date.
Hmm. I would like to congratulate both of you for the work you're doing, which is exactly where it needs to be done right now. I think in the law and in the digital world, we have so much entered the digital space, haven't we? And we so much need the lawyers to begin to work for us more proactively. And Katja, you are making that push in that direction. Now on the rounding off, the good news is that we've talked about briefly about Greta Thunberg and her leadership and how she has inspired an entire young generation on the planet. We're talking about that she has 230 million people following her. You know, it's huge. Now, on the 25th of September, there is going to be yet another of these climate strikes. I don't know here in Australia how much it will be out in the streets. Certainly it will move into the online space, which is also interesting. But on that note of Greta Thunberg, I just wanted to hear a last comment from both of you. What's your take on the situation in the world right now? Are you optimistic? Are we heading the right way? It's also confusing. There's so many news coming from all sides. But where are you?
I'm optimistic. I mean, I've always been an optimist. And I've always believed in fairness and the power of individuals to create change. And yes, I know that many people in the world are concerned right now for many reasons, whether it's because we're seeing, you know, leadership in certain countries that's leaning very much to the right. You know, when I was living in Paris, so I have a lot of friends in London from my days back there. So many people were really concerned about Brexit and what would happen to the EU after that. A lot of people since COVID have felt scared about their futures. But I think, you know, that as long as people like Katja and I and all of us continue to raise our voices, stand in solidarity with each other, and continue to believe that as individuals and through our work in our communities and you know, our professional and the way that we consume and every thing that we do, we can create change. And I'm a big believer that the pendulum always swings. So, you know, we don't know when that swing might happen, but it always does. And that's definitely something that's happened throughout political history, societal history. So, yes, we might be living in quite, you know, I keep using the phrase crazy COVID times. It is a strange world right now. But one thing that COVID has, I think, you know, you touched on before, brought out, is people are really realizing what matters in life, what's important in life. And it's connecting, it's showing kindness. It's not about consumption. It's not about getting on planes. It's about showing kindness and respect and doing everyone doing their part to, you know, make sure that our world or our small parts of the world remain safe and opportunities for everyone continue to exist. And I'm a big believer through my own podcast that I do, through the activism that I do, you know, I continue to promote inclusion, diversity, self-empowerment and equality for all. So, yeah, I'm an optimist.
I think we all are. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. And you, final word from Kata.
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, honestly, at the same time, there's definitely days where denial and inaction leads to despair, but I think we can definitely be hopeful because, yeah, change is inevitable, and I think it just comes from the need for us all to start respecting our country. We need our air and our land and our water to survive, and I think that it's pretty basic to respect that, and we definitely can. It's not unachievable, and that's all we really need to do.
Thank you very much. That's all we could fit in the Sustainable Hour today. Now all we have to do is go out there and then we live the difference, as we say now.
Yep, live the difference.
Thanks for having us.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you so much and bonne journée.
Here's a song about climate change. Mother Nature burnt in a summer rage. That's why we must change. Towns reduced to dust. A sign of things to come in climate chaos. We need your voice today. Lead the way. We're all in this together. The climate's changing fast. We know it's now or never, make it last. Think about your vote. It's time to have your say. Eden Monero, lead the way. Koalas choke with nowhere to run. From the orange glow of fire to the red-eyed sun. I'd say there's work to be done. Everyone, we're all in this together. The climate's changing fast. We know it's now or never, make it last. Whoa. Think about your vote. It's time to have your say. Eden Monero, lead the way. Our children's futures hang on what we do today. The winds of change have blown away. From Cabago to the Snowies, to the shores of Tubal Bay. Yeah. Eden Monero, have your say. Eden Monero, lead the way.
I know the world's gone mad, it's true. Be the difference.
Many people say that Sweden is just a small country and it doesn't matter what we do. But I've learned that you are never too small to make a difference. And if a few children can get headlines all over the world just by not going to school, then imagine what we could all do together if we really wanted to.
Be the difference.
darling, the future's watching us. So am I gonna open everything up? Am I gonna let fury fill my cup? Am I gonna be an anthem singing in the dark? Gonna light up like a burning heart? Am I gonna stand still?